Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Happy, what's the day? Tuesday, is it Tuesday? Happy Tuesday, everybody. Robert Choate has just announced that public sector redundancies will be 700,000 rather than the 400,000 that he said in March. So I think my brief is meant to talk about what do customers of local government want, but I just thought I'd talk a bit about that and some things that certainly if I was running an authority, I would want to be conveying to my electorate and consumers at this time. There are lots of slides. I'm sure the organisers will have them on a splendid intranet somewhere, but if you want them, do email me and I will send them to you. And apparently this makes them go backwards and forwards. Because I think the evidence is more and more that we are living in quite extraordinary times, and this is going to play out in terms of what we do. Local government at the end of this process really isn't going to be quite the same, I don't think. It's going to be in a different sort of shape. We seem to be doing unitaries through the back door, all sorts of things that will gradually become clear. And the way I tend to see this overall period, in a sense, is that we've just had an odd decade. So many of you in this room, I can remember getting into university in 1982 and being very, very pleased because I knew I'd be able to get a job. And we seem to be going back to that stage. So the last, if anybody who started work after about 1995 really can't quite imagine what we are now about to enter, but certainly I think that is the case. So if we can... working? No? Oh, good, okay. So the first thing is just that, obviously, the setting that we have to remember, if we're going to communicate with our publics, we have to think about the situation in which we're communicating. And the bottom line is the numbers are ghastly. People are very worried about the economy. The only sort of shred of hope in this chart, in many ways, is that although people are absolutely anxious about the economy, concern about unemployment is actually still at a historic low, which shows that it could get, in terms of the national mood, things could get much worse. During the 1970s, I've got a clip on mic so I can walk around. During the 1970s and 1980s, concern about unemployment, which is currently here, actually got to here. So in terms of the pain, it's in every recession, like every relationship, is different. We haven't quite seen it. Now, the numbers are going up, but there is this absolute recognition that the economy is the biggest issue facing the country. That's been the highest level of anxiety at a prolonged level that we've seen since we started this series of questions in the 1970s. You've still got your old favourites, crime, immigration, the NHS, which I can talk about if you want to. And in some ways, you've had your crisis early. The NHS has got theirs coming. But when it explodes, it will be much more interesting than you, unfortunately, because it does actually have the potential to be the poll tax for the Conservatives. Well, have a look in about 2013-14, particularly in outer London, in terms of what's about to happen. But, of course, when you ask people individually what they're concerned about, it's prices. Now, this is the depressing chart. This looks at growth in wages since 1990, median wages. You can see that between about 1990 and 2003, people did actually get better off. And Gordon Brown, after about 2003, Gordon Brown continued talking about endless quarters of successive growth. And increasingly, he got less and less credible as he said it. You can see why now, because it wasn't actually for most people. We were expanding the economy by importing people who made the economy grow, but actual people's lived experience was not better. And now, of course, we're seeing a real fall. Now, admittedly, we're only going to be as poor as we were perhaps around 2000 or something. So it's not the end of the world, but it's certainly the sort of idea that we're getting better off and better off is certainly going. It's the first time that we've seen people generally believing that their kids are going to be worse off than they are, which is not something that we've seen since we were set up in 1969. So when we ask people working in the public sector what they think the biggest issues are, money just is the top issue. And in a sense, although I'm trying to talk about the public, it is interesting that, it's not about efficiency, it's not about accountability, it's not about, demographic change. We have obviously a perfect storm of demography hitting us at the same time as the funding crisis. It's purely about just less money to spend. And that's a message that in some ways goes down quite well with the public. So the sort of pitch that Stephen's just made is one of the reasons why he is about the only authority in England in the last survey before we stopped doing local surveys all the time in 2008 that saw rising satisfaction because he had, plastered the borough with how he was saving money all the time. So, actually there is some good news. When you look at the long-term trends, this is how much people trust Parliament. And this is how much people say they trust their local council. So the question, in some ways, is... I think there's another thing. Yep, there you go. Whether that will actually go on, and we'll just get more and more loved up. Now, I'm not sure. On this basis, at some point, local government would be seen as the sort of great white knights. You know, people, MPs would be resigning their seats to go and become council leaders for this brilliant institution. But it is, trying to dig into this is quite interesting, why it should be that somehow local government's more and more trusted, central government less and less. The gap, you know, what, 18 points, 16 points at the start, and, you know, well, you know, going well over 20-something points later on. So, you know, that in some ways is quite cheerful. I just don't know if that will actually continue. We've got our latest survey we're about to publish, our annual survey on the state of local government, shows that only 44% think they get the thing that we're about to talk about. So in terms of the things that people really, really want to hear, this man knows the answers. And this man is the second most popular Conservative politician in Britain. He knows the answers. People like him a lot in the Conservative Party. He knows his audience. They like him. He likes them. And he does things that they like. And in one sense, he's absolutely on the ticket, because we've always known that this has been a key driver of reputation. It's not about the actual level of council tax, although important though it is. It is about perceptions of value for money. And the councils that do best are always those that persuade people that, you know, they've banned carpet from the town hall because it's wasteful. They've scrapped all the pot plants. You know, yet again, they've driven down X, Y, and Z. So he's absolutely on the ticket. I do think that in our communications, we need to just remember, you know, we're under the cosh, people working in the public sector under the cosh, but then again, so, as you can see from the numbers out there, in terms of real wages, particularly median wages in this country, are a real issue, because for many local authorities, unlike, say, Westminster, a large proportion of the people they serve are about to see, you know, real falls in living standards for the first time in a long period. And so that means being, you know, some empathy. Because it's interesting, when we ask people in the crunch who was doing best to really look after you, what do you get? 53% saying the supermarket, 7% saying local government. So Tesco cares more about you than does your local elected local authority. And maybe it does. Tesco, the interesting thing about Tesco is it is absolutely and relentlessly focused on trying to give people things cheaper. It's rather boring. It's not very. It doesn't want to save the planet. It doesn't want to be nice to people. But it does want to give you things cheaper, because that will mean you'll be more likely to buy them than go to Waitrose. Local government, of course, tries to do a million things, and the risk is, of course, it then ends up absolutely delighting and pleasing nobody. But it is interesting, isn't it, that the supermarkets tended to do best, because in all of their communications, what are they saying? Every little helps. You know, et cetera, a little bit more, Asda, I don't know, what's that one, bloody Asda price or something, but, you know, very, very clear that they are on your side, they're listening to you, they understand the crunch, they've got a meal for two for Saturday night for £10. You know, they've thought about what you need. We aren't very good at packaging what we do or communicating very clearly or changing our tune. We just stick with long-term messages about, you know, being nice to people, equality, I don't know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Localism, of course, one thing we could be very excited about. I think here, you know, the public, just as politicians, are riven through with contradictions, which explains why localism isn't going to happen in this country anytime soon. You can write that down if you like. You know, because people say things like, you know, in opinion polls, well, do you want the experts to run public services? They know best. They should find out what you want and then get on with it. Or do you want to be much more involved, perhaps choosing, you know, what you get locally? Maybe you, in this part of the borough, need something different than in the part of the borough with the big houses or the small houses. That sounds like a great idea, you know. Half the population say they strongly agree with that. Much more than those might disagree and leave it to the experts. And then you say, but what would you like? Do you want people who live in the different parts of Britain to decide what they get themselves? So if they need something in John O'Groats that's different in Land's End, they should be able to decide for themselves. Or do you want everything to be the same everywhere? And 4 times more people want something to be the same everywhere than not. So there are lots of local determination. This ward will have it and this ward won't. But then somebody somewhere's got to make sure everything's the same, not only inside your authority, but across all authorities. And this is a huge problem, of course, so this central challenge. I mean, in the same health services, we've got Andrew Lansley offering us all sorts of differentiation, but 81% want health services to be the same everywhere in Britain. So you can only have things in Land's End if they're also available in John O'Groats. Recycling. You know, Eric Pickles is a big fan of this. He's absolutely determined that you will collect the rubbish in the same way every place, every week. You're not allowed to, some of you do it one week and not the other week, or a bit of, no, it's the same. He knows it's important. And of course, this is called cognitive polyphasia, which many of us exhibit in different aspects of our lives, which is wanting our cake and eat it. So, you know, we want to be, you know, we say things like we're very worried about the pollution that's caused by air travel, and then we express the view that we intend to fly more like everybody else. And how, I think, but just tapping into some of that in one's communications is probably a good idea. In terms of community empowerment and the big society, again, you know, one might be tempted to take a leaf out of the Prime Minister's book and offer everybody the chance to come and take over services and run things. I think the evidence on this is very, very mixed. We know that about 4 people in 100 say they're already involved. Now, given that 4 in 100 already work for local government or thereabouts, or did until the cuts, you know, since that's just as well that it is 4 in 100, we've got about 5% who say they want more involvement, but most people just want to know what the hell's going on, and that isn't changing. And that is one of the central challenges. This belief that everybody will suddenly rise up and come to our committee meetings or get involved, it seems to be misplaced. Now, we do know that people are doing things. There's these people who go around putting flowers in potholes to draw attention to them. Some people are creating their own signs. And if you are interested in one service to think about, I would be very interested, if I was interested in getting elected, particularly in a county council area, I would be very, very interested in potholes indeed. I would be absolutely obsessed about them. I wouldn't worry too much about education, because despite people in government being worried about it, most of the punters aren't. But I would be very, very interested in potholes. But in terms of, you know, however we can get this, you know, we can just put the sort of grit out there and ask people to go and fill them in themselves with spades that we provide. I mean, you know, Islington, I think, was handing out snow shovels for people to sort of do it themselves. One of the challenges is this chart, which is that as we withdraw the state, make the state smaller, which is one of the ambitions of this government, and the budget today helps, you know, helps that on its way. The problem is that, of course, there's a direct correlation with poverty, and the lower the level of employment, the higher the level of unemployment, the higher the level of poverty, the fewer volunteers you get in either a formal or informal sense. So if you serve a very rich community, then the big society is an excellent idea. Place sort of retired villages full of retired bankers would be an excellent place to run the big society. A bad place to run it would probably be somewhere on the right. That's the sort of this chart is places like Hart on the Surrey-Hampshire border. But on the right, you know, somewhere like bits of Brent, Hackney, bits of Liverpool, you don't expect lots of things to happen as you close down state services there. And this is the trend in terms of the number of people who say they've volunteered. So during this amazing period of expansion in public services, with lots of efforts to encourage people to get involved, I've sat in rooms like this in not very far from here with ministers and civil servants, people talking about empowerment for years and years and years. And then here is the evidence of empowerment. This is what happened. And of course, it shows that if anything, empowerment fell. It then fell again after the election. But then, fortunately, Eric Pickles has cancelled the survey, so we don't know what happened next. It may have suddenly shot up, but we'll never know. You can either draw a line on the chart anywhere you like. We don't know. The other issue, of course, that many politicians know is that, of course, getting people involved doesn't always make them happy. And we know, of course, that we can involve people by giving them lots of reasons to be unhappy. So we know that if we offer to build a paedophile hostel in their neighbourhood or a big motorway, many people will get involved. And in fact, if you talk to your own politicians, you know, why do they get into politics? I remember Hazel, I can't remember her surname, who was chief executive leader of Lancashire. You know, why did she get involved? To stop the county council closing a children's centre in her village. Nick Skellett, former leader of Surrey, why did he get involved in politics? To stop Surrey County Council building on some land near where he lived. So one positive thing may be that you'll have lots of opportunities to engage new people in political process in your communities as the cuts bite, because they will get involved to stop things happening. And I guess the demonstration in London is, you know, a lot of people there, well, are they coming to London? They're not coming to promote something. They're coming to London to stop something happening tomorrow. So some really big challenges, and I think particularly over some of the things around community planning, local plans, some huge issues there, again, in terms of how much rhetoric we give people locally about the real level of control that they can have. But I would certainly offer it. So I may sound cynical about it, and that's really because just comparing the ambition of politicians' rhetoric from all parties with what has actually happened over the last 2 decades tends to make one a little bit cynical. But nevertheless, I think a key thing in one's communications has got to be, we need to demonstrate to people that there are workable avenues for them to have impact if they want to use them. The belief that everybody is odd like us and wants to come and sit in rooms like this and discuss local government is a deeply perverse one. However, We do need to offer people the opportunities and make sure we communicate those opportunities, which is absolutely key, to our local electorate. So showing people, we did this because you said, we've talked about this in the past, we've seen, councils running these sorts of campaigns, but those remain as relevant as ever, and they are precisely the sorts of themes that we see in the private sector. So we need to, look at things that work. We know that getting people engaged does work, but we also know it's hard to do that. I think a key group of people who tend to get ignored or just sacked are actually people working for us. And, one of the most potent forms of communication this century remains exactly the same as 5 centuries ago, the human voice, particularly when we're bombarded with electronic messages. So, we know that if we look at the best performing councils in this room and the worst, if I was to give half the room 5% year-on-year, pay rises, and this half of the room, I'm afraid you're only going to get 0.5% for the next 5 years. When we come to look at the performance of the different authorities involved, there will be very little correlation with the actual pay that was paid out. And there will be much stronger correlations. This is from work that we did for the IDA and for the Centre for Local Leadership, much stronger correlations in terms of people feeling listened to, clear about what they're trying to achieve in the organisation as a whole, being told how they're doing, being given autonomy. And in times like this, when we need radical solutions, that must be really important. Now, I won't go on and do some horrible lecture about the range of ways in which we can actually understand what people want. I think local government knows about them, it does seem to relearn them every couple of years. But we just do need to make sure that we aren't just sort of printing out questionnaires or hoping that strange people who like filling in questionnaires on the web are our only way of finding out about things. We do know that in terms of how we deliver services, people aren't that fussed. I think I've got a load of slides here, which I'll just click through quickly because they're boring. But on that, effectively, what we know is that people are very upset about outsourcing until it happens. One of the first things I did in my job at Ipsos Mori in the late 1980s was work for somebody called Michael Howard, along with a sidekick called Nicholas Ridley, just over there in Marsham Street, actually, when we were employed to sell off the water industry. This, at the time, we had a poll showing 90% of British voters were opposed to it. And Nicholas Ridley showed why he was a much better politician than me, because he, as we put up a slide like this, he goes, next slide, please. People smoked in offices, of course, in the 1980s. Next slide, please. They'll forget about it next year. And, of course, I was aghast at this point. I was just absolutely aghast. But, of course, the point there is that, yes, people didn't particularly feel good about selling off the water industry, but actually, ultimately, it wasn't absolutely that salient. Rail privatisation, we can talk about Hatfield crashes, but actually, ultimately, today, people aren't that bothered about rail privatisation. So they don't like outsourcing things until it happens. They weren't that keen when you outsource refuse collection, to be honest, as a general principle. But now we can show you both, we can show you in-house and external services that both have very high levels of satisfaction. So I think, as long as it works, it's all right. It'll be interesting to see if the car crash of reorganisation in the NHS actually turns into the Conservatives' poll tax, because it could. But at the moment, satisfaction in the NHS is still at an all-time high, and people aren't that obsessed about the reorganisation, however much the unions talk about it. I do think in our communications, though, we should look at this number. This is, of course, the number of NEETs. These are the people who you will be looking after, sweeping up, who will be making people feel scared in years to come. Your voters, of course, many of whom are old, don't worry too much about these people because they figure they'll be dead by the time the trouble really hits the fan. But it is, some seriously depressing news on this, because most people do agree with David Cameron that parts of society are not simply broken, but frankly sick, 69%. They don't think they should all go to jail, although another statistic while I'm throwing them out today, we've just passed the all-time high of number of people in jail, 88,000, up from 44,000 in 1992. Concern about crime, according to the British Crime Service, an all-time low, so I leave that to you to figure. But certainly we are concerned about the state of society, and I think those people are there, and communicating about those people in our communities matters. And then finally, I think, relationships, service still matter. And so we just need to be absolutely clear about this sort of thing. What are those things that you do, particularly as money is in shorter and shorter supply, that ultimately really make people happy. Because, you know, if you look at this sort of chart, this looks at performance. So the further to the right, the more you do something. And the vertical axis, the more they like you. What are those things that the more they do, the more you do them, the more they love you? What are those things that if you do them badly, they get very cross? And what are those things that are sort of critical? As they get better, things go on improving. So we need to be very clear about that, because there are certain things that as long as we get them done to just a certain standard, that's enough. So cutlery in restaurants. You know, when you had your lunch, you might have used a piece of cutlery. I don't know how your lunch was provided today. As long as the fork wasn't dirty, you will be satisfied. You know, you weren't expecting a fork to be sort of, you know, biologically pure, just cast from fresh metal, never used by another human being. So we could obviously go and make forks like that. We could have a machine that used molten metal for every person. It'd be absolutely perfect. People don't expect that. At the same time, but if it's dirty, you would be cross. If it was covered in, you know, dried matter, you would not be happy. So clean forks are not, they're up to a certain standard, it's okay. So, but where is that point? Similarly, another one would be when you walked in the front door, a nice person there at reception, if she said, Mary McGraw, lovely to see you, you'd have been, oh my God, that's pretty amazing. If she said, the conference is on the first floor, you'd be, okay, well, that's what normally happens in this sort of building. So that's a delight. So can we find those things? It didn't cost very much for her to know who was coming, or to have, maybe it does, take your photographs, download them from the web, recognize you when you come in the door. If you're really important and come and see me, you can judge how important you are. That does happen in my building. And then what are those things that as you do them, you get happier and happier? Maybe the price of this conference, you know, when it gets down to a penny, you think it's an absolute bargain, you know, et cetera. Maybe not. And then, of course, in all of these things, the zone of tolerance. So this is where we've made a change to our service. We're trying to convince the leader that it's all right, but nothing's got better yet. And this is simply that we haven't changed it enough, because things do not move in a linear fashion. As you make an improvement to a service, you won't necessarily immediately see people get happier. So in the NHS, when they halved waiting times from 6 months to 3 months, it made no impression on satisfaction with the NHS at all. And it was only when they hit under 12 weeks that satisfaction really started motoring away from a sort of plateau. So I think being clear about that. And if we are thinking about the people that we matter, I think one of the central questions facing public services is, are we one size fits all, which is terribly democratic and egalitarian, or do we try and copy some of the better aspects of the private sector, which is that people aren't all one size fits all. Our communities are rarely like that these days. Can you try and find those things and this is the sorts of things the private sector is obsessed about, you know, authenticity and recognition. We know who you are in a nice way, and therefore that, you know, you've just had a baby, maybe you'd want this free Pampers offer or something like that. And also that we differentiate you. We don't just treat you like the same thing. Now, that's the sort of holy grail that if local government could start to do, some issues about fairness, I guess, but that's what people want. They want to be recognised. And in a bigger and busier world, that seems to be a huge challenge. The interesting thing is that the private sector, whose absolute lives and existences depend on this, themselves have every bit as much of a problem with this as you do. When we look at there, they spend a fortune on loyalty. How many loyalty cards have you got? Can you put up your hands? Have you got one? Keep your hand up. You got two? You know, three? You know, we've got loads of these bloody things. And what do the people, they're spending millions and millions and millions on them, and yet still only 9 people in 100 in the private sector would say their databases are actually very effective in identifying them. So it's hard to do, but it's those things that, you know that when you go into a local shop, they know who you are. They remember you. These sorts of things that we need to think about as we develop services. So I will shut up, but just say ultimately it will still come down to, as we go through this very difficult period, how we take our people with us. Our people remain some of the most potent communicators. Them going on strike tomorrow is not good news in terms of us communicating about how much we love everybody when our staff can't be bothered to turn up for work. Many of our residents also staff, of course. But some challenges. So the first thing I'll say finally then is that it's lovely to be with you, because you are actually, you may not know it after sitting here all day, you are actually the most cheerful people in the public sector. People employed in local government are actually happier and more optimistic about the future than any other part. Now, this may seem hot tough, but just know how it, well, this is because you've had the crap. You've done your front-loaded cuts. For other people, the NHS is still in denial. They're still just sort of contemplating the avalanche of cuts that are about to break over their heads. They've sort of got away with it in the first year. The solids are about to hit the fan there. So you're the more optimistic people. I do think you should think hard about, I know a reputation is always a popular thing in local government, and I've been involved in that in the past, but I do think increasingly as we go forward, it's, you know, polishing things up to look good is probably not appropriate in this climate. But we do need to really try and have those conversations with people about the choices that we're making, and in some senses the crisis gives us that chance to have that conversation. We should encourage our politicians to be more like Stephen rather than invisible grey people and have those conversations. We may not all like Stephen, but you can be pretty clear about what he stands for, what he believes in, what he's trying to do. And we need to have those conversations. We know that in terms of where things are coming out, it will be the young, and we need to think about how we communicate to families in particular and to young people. It's absolutely the case that inequality is going to go up. But we have at the same time an amazing opportunity. So I haven't, because of the need for brevity. How am I doing on time, Chair? Okay. Oh, good, good. I haven't talked really about technology, partly because it's boring. But how many of you use Twitter? Okay, well, there's quite a lot of Twitter people. That's good, because you'll know what all the young people are saying about your council, if they even know what it is, of course. It's funny, I was doing this with a load of head teachers the other day, and hardly any of them used it. So I just think the kids must be going wild, slagging you off, and you'll have absolutely no idea. But we are at a tipping point in technology. I mean, when I started work in 1986, I was actually making charts by drawing round cups and sticking little bits of plastic down to indicate the size, and working out with a protractor and a calculator what the angle should be to indicate sort of 37% on a pie chart. Now, obviously, things that used to take me all afternoon, I can now do in 1 second. In that way, I think in terms of some of the techniques that are out there for you to use things like passive measurement, social media, et cetera, there is just amazing stuff. We should be giving all school children. We have 20,000 people walking around London with free Blackberries. Now, why does Ipsos Mori give 20,000 people free Blackberries? It's not, strangely, out of any reason for generosity. We do it so we know where they are at all times. So you get a free BlackBerry and we know where you are. We use the GPS signals to work out the price of every poster site in London, because we can map on in real time where 20,000 people make foot journeys in London. We can then work out, using algorithms, what they're looking at. We know when they go to bed. We know when they wake up, or at least when they turn on and off the phones. We know what they're listening to, because the app actually listens to radio signals, and it picks up the encoded digital signal that is in all radio stations, which we use to build the radio listening survey that we conduct, which works out the price of all radio advertising in Britain. We know what websites they look at. We know who they phone. Now, clearly we don't use all that information, and they've swapped their anonymity in return for completely free telephony and internet usage. So for them, it seems to be all right. Their usage of pornography seems to be somewhat lower than the general population, at least on these devices. But I'm just using that as a point, because if I was in charge of a load of kids, they love this stuff. I would give them all. I would make sure my schools gave them all free Blackberries, because you can tell when they're not going to bed. My son, I can tell when he's not asleep, because I'm divorced, because I can see what he's actually doing. Number 23, do your homework, stop pissing around watching X Factor. This is here and now. Visa can predict when you will get divorced within 2 years at 90% accuracy, according to Google, and they're very interested in you getting divorced, and the reason for this is not that they're into moral probity, but simply that people who get divorced do not pay their visa bills. So they like to look at people who might be exhibiting, so I don't know if they look at purchases of flowers, hotels, jewellery, or something else, but anyway, we know that every single car in North America now has its own email address. So you're driving along the Californian highway, you see a blonde hottie of either sex, and you can actually send them an email. Just type in their number plate and write at bomb.com, and they will get the email. So if you run a school or a McDonald's, you can use your optical character recognition. You say you were parking outside at 8:45, blocking the highway, please don't do it again. If you're McDonald's, you can write to them and say, last week you came in and had 2 cheeseburgers and fries. Have you considered a lighter option? I'm just saying that there is this breaking over us, and I would definitely look at thinking about that. Some of this does offer some amazing ways of doing things if we're willing to use some of the tech. The challenge we have, of course, with our egalitarian hats on, is that we still have a large number of people who have absolutely no intention of using this technology. And so we've got this sort of two-speed system where only 20% of working-class women over 65, many of whom vote, and many of them may be your members, they are not going to be doing any of this stuff anytime soon, and they will have to die before internet penetration hits over 90%. However, for the younger ones, I think it is, there are some amazing things. And the other thing is that in Britain today, although people don't trust politicians, it is absolutely the case that a quarter of the population still say that the people in charge know best. So all I would suggest is that rapidly that you find these colleagues at work and work them to death. But, you know, some people will do what they're told. With the rioters, I think the other thing is that, of course, if we're looking at young people, again, families. When you go back and look at the criminal records or otherwise of people who got arrested and the people known to the police or not known to the police, what's fascinating is just the chaotic backgrounds of all of the people. When you sit in the Home Office and go through the records, all the people who got nicked who weren't known to the police, you know, what had happened there, and a large part of it, of course, is about family. So again, if we're trying to communicate, everything around young people is absolutely what we should be focusing on. So all I'd say finally is, and I'll just leave you with a quote from Albert Einstein, because I think it's just a reminder to all of us, and that is simply that, you know, the greatest form of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and hoping that something different will happen. It would seem to me that we are at that point where we really do have to try some new things, unless we're happy with the results that we've been getting so far. And that's a pressure on all of us. It's a pressure in my organisation, which could go out of existence in 2 years. Just like that, we're now the third largest research organisation in the world, 16,000 employees. But we know that we could be gone in 2 years. We work for an organisation called Google. They're just on the other side of Victoria. For them, we're like a small fish that cleans the teeth of a large shark. We're just nibbling away. They're very helpfully, but sometime the shark might get hungry. So we need to try something new as well. But I just wish you all the luck in the world. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.